Thanks for downloading this show from PC One. Before we get rolling, here's a word from one of the folks who helped bring you this podcast.
All right, everyone knows the whole world shops online now. And of course, Amazon is the biggest online mall in the universe. But did you know that every time you use Amazon, you could also be helping me keep this podcast going? That is correct. If you get to Amazon via my Amazon banner when you shop, a small amount of the purchase will go directly to help support this podcast at no extra cost to you. So here's how you do it. Just go to Podcast One, click on the Killer Deals link, then scroll and find my show logo, and then you will see Amazon along with all my sponsors. Then you click on the link, and then you just shop on Amazon as you normally would. So this is a really easy way that you can help us keep doing this podcast for free each week. Also, if you wouldn't mind bookmarking that link so it's super easy to use the next time you shop on Amazon, I would really appreciate it.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com presentation.
Hey everybody, I am sitting here on a Sunday morning. It's nice and sunny here in Chicago. I'm in a soundproof booth on the morning of my son's first birthday. Theo, he is 1 year old. He's my first child, so this is a big deal, big milestone for me. We're having a little party, actually, and it starts in 38 minutes, so I have to hurry up here. Anyway, as much as I have been talking in recent weeks about my new life as an entrepreneur, it's really my new life as a father that has defined this past year for me. And any desire I have to be a successful entrepreneur really pales compared to my desire to be a good father. And a couple of weeks ago, I happened to drive a guy to the airport who, he's also a father, he's also an entrepreneur, and he had similar thoughts. He phrased it like this.
You go through life and people have a variety of titles, but the best title I will ever have is dad. You know, you can be a president, you can be a CEO, all that other stuff. But, you know, at the end, when you're kind of looking back, you're not going to be saying, gosh, I wish I had obtained another title. I wish I'd been a better dad, a parent, a brother.
He's in his 50s. He owns his own production company, and he's got a unique perspective on raising children. And that is because he has got two sets of children almost 20 years apart from one another.
I have children from an earlier marriage. They're 19 and 21. And I have children that are 3 and 4. I have two daughters that are younger. The 3-year-old is Taylor. The 4-year-old is Ava. My son is Nick, he's 19, and my daughter, Jordan, is 21. So I've kind of had a chance to re-remember or to see again the things you might have forgotten.
Re-remember, see again, and perhaps make some operational improvements.
It's nice to have an opportunity at both ages. I'm in my 50s now, and to have raised children in my 30s as well to kind of learn maybe from some of the mistakes I made earlier.
Now, as a new dad, I'm approaching parenthood with all kinds of optimism. In my mind, it's like, I'm going to raise the most well-adjusted kid ever. And with this passenger, we had a long ride from downtown to O'Hare, and I could tell he had his head on straight. So I asked him what some of the keys are to good parenting, and he had a lot of really good wisdom to share, but really boiled it down to one thing.
You give your children, you know, love. You give them unconditional love. Yeah, I find a lot of times you'll see parents will give children conditional love. And that teaches them to adapt to those conditions in order to receive love, because at an early age, that's what you want, right?
That thought stuck with me. Not just the unconditional love part, which I get what that is. It was the idea of the opposite, conditional love, that got me wondering, what would conditional love from a parent to a child look like? I grew up in a very loving and supportive household, so I don't really have that internalized. And I know I'm really lucky, by the way, to be able to say that. So that conversation with him happened a few weeks ago. Now, fast forward to this week. This week, initially, I set out to explore the theme of regret with my passengers. And this was a topic suggestion that came from a listener like you. And I really liked it because it's one of those topics that I think we can probably all learn from by hearing what other people most regret in life. We can avoid making those same mistakes. So here's what happened, though. A couple days ago, I got in the car with the mindset to ask all my passengers to tell me about their biggest regrets in life. And then something odd happened. This is really bizarre. The very first guy I picked up and asked that question to, he answered it like this.
What would you say your biggest regret is, and why?
I'll say at a young age in high school, not living life to the fullest. Even though I was in JRTC, I had a controlling mom. So whenever I came home, I was stuck home. Even though she wasn't there, I always was home. It's like a prison.
Controlling mom, home was like a prison. Regrets not living life to the fullest when he was in that situation. Hasn't talked to his mom in 4 years. And then the very next person I picked up through the same question at him answered it like this.
What's the thing you regret most and why?
In my entire life.
Yeah, could be anything. Childhood, teenage years, adult years, career decision, relationship. You can answer it any way you want.
Yeah.
Or not answer.
I would say in some ways, probably, I've got a very, well now, kind of a completely estranged relationship with my mother.
So there was apparently something in the air that day. I had this very general question, you hear me there, encouraging that guy to answer it however he wanted. And the very first two people I drove, both guys, both talking about being estranged from their mothers, of all things. So to me, that was the universe, perhaps trying to answer my question from the airport ride and show me what conditional love might look like.
I moved out second at the age of 17.
This guy is now 22 years old. I'm going to call him Julian. Julian is one of four brothers, one older, one younger, one twin. And he paints a picture of his mother taking care of all the brothers on some level, except for him.
Him being the oldest, he always got what he got from my mom. My twin brother always got what he wanted because he had two brain tumors when he was younger. So he was more the person that needed the attention. Yeah. Then the youngest brother got what he kind of wanted. But since he was the youngest one, he got what he wanted. For me.
So you just kind of got left out.
Yes.
By your mom.
Yeah. Well, growing up, she's a 400% Ecuadorian. So whatever she could grab to hit us with, she would hit us with it.
I asked Julian for an example of being singled out, and he brought up the issue of food. More specifically, not getting enough to eat. And to put this next anecdote into context, he is 5'10" tall.
Right now, I weigh 146. I actually, 3 years ago, before I moved out, I was weighing 110 pounds.
Was she not feeding you?
Yeah. Well, I'll say I ate, but not as often as my brothers did. Like, it was over the summer of 2012 or 2013, once after I graduated. I'll be sleeping, and my mom would go take my brothers without waking me up to go eat at breakfast. So I'll wake up and say, oh, there's no one here. Let me check the fridge. Oh, there's nothing. Oh, okay, just let me sit down, watch TV until she comes back.
He says things like that would happen regularly. And then he brought up something really scary that happened to him one day while he was at school.
I didn't say this, but during my high school, my lung collapsed in my senior year.
How?
I was too tall, very skinny. And then during the time, I was working out, doing some physical training with all the other cadets. But I wasn't really exercising. I was more of the person just like, hey, this is what we're going to do. Okay, we're going to do this exercise. And then when it was time for running, I was doing like a light jog, but then I couldn't just breathe at one point. So I was like, man, I'm going to sit down for a second. It's like, and my instructor was like, oh, are you okay? He's like, I'm just having a hard time breathing. So when I went to the hospital, they called the ambulance and told my mom that I was having some problems breathing. So they took me to the hospital and said that my lung collapsed on my left side. And he said, you almost had a slight heart attack because all that air was compressing against my chest, where it was on my left side of my chest, where my heart is. So lucky for me that I was transferred to the hospital, and they told me, like, well, it's not that much. It's they didn't have to poke a hole to leak out the air. So just, like, just let it heal on itself, and it'll be fine. So when my mom picked me up the next day, she was, like, so pissed because I had the ambulance pick me up where you had to pay for the ambulance. So she wasn't happy to see me, so she didn't say, oh, are you okay? How are you? How's it feel? And it was, like, a scary point in my life. I was like, whoa. And then I would say to that point where the reason why I had my lung collapse because I was too skinny, not eating, and too tall. So I would say during those points in life, or before that, it was a struggle to find food in my house. Like, she would buy milk and cereal, but three boys, we eat cereal in the morning, afternoon if there's no food, and then in the evening because there's no food. And I'll say sometimes I'll just grab a spoon of sugar to eat.
Now, another kid, hungry enough, might have, I don't know, gone to a friend's house or a neighbor's house to try to get some food. But you heard Julian there at the top of the interview compare his house to a prison.
Even though I had straight A's, my mom always kept us in.
So for most of his childhood, he was in the mindset that he couldn't even leave.
For me, I only lived three blocks away from my for school. And I would be there at 6:45 in the morning for JRTC, drill team and stuff. And then I'll stay after school for a little bit to organize for the next day for school. Then come home. I was a 3.5 GPA student, so I always did my homework in school or in class. So when I just come home, I just sit home, do nothing.
And Julian says that he lost a lot of his motivation in getting good grades, doing JROTC, right around the time of that collapsed lung incident.
I kind of went into depression, saying, why should I do this if my mom doesn't care for me?
So what's going on with your mom that she feels, I mean, I think all parents feel a certain level of the need to control their children to keep them safe, you know? But it sounds like your mom took it to a unhealthy level.
Yeah.
Was going on with her that she did that?
To this day, I cannot say. All I could hear from my aunt is, like, she always was controlling over us. I can never figure it out.
Does your mom suffer from some mental health issues that she treated you like that?
Well, I would say she had... Well, I think right now, this is my speculation, that I would say that my mom has bipolar because my twin brother also has bipolar. I would say at some points in my life, I noticed that she'll have mood swings. She'll be at this point happy, next point mad, back to happy, and then back to mad. But I cannot really tell if she really has anything. I actually found out when I was younger, or till right at that, I found out when I was younger she did drugs.
Was your dad unable to help you through this period?
He's not in a great point in life, so I can't really get help from him. So I would say, like, the only person that could really help myself is myself. I have my aunt, who's not really my aunt. She's actually a person my mom knew when I grew up. I just called her my aunt throughout my whole life. Yeah. So it was actually weird how I have all this family, but I have to do this on my own.
And Julian says toward the end of high school, the anger and the resentment toward his mom was about to boil over. And at that point, that aunt that he mentioned, who's really a family friend, he just calls her an aunt, offered to take him in so that he could escape from, again, a home that he described as a prison. And this is remarkable right here. He remembers the exact date that he left.
I moved out at the age of 17, went to my aunt, took me in for 2 days, and then she's like, we'll help you get to school. So that's when my life changed. Even on my Facebook, I put, my life changed on this day, August 18th. 2013.
August 18th, 2013. That is the day the abuse stopped.
It wasn't always hitting. It was more verbal, that where it hurt, to where it was like, oh, you're nothing, you're just going to be like your dad. So I don't remember the last time she hit me, but I can remember all the time she said that I was going to be nothing in life.
And when was the last time she said that?
It'll be on that last day, or the second, the 17th of August, the day before I moved out. And she was at work at the time when I left. I didn't say bye to her. I just said hey to my twin and my youngest brother. I was like, hey guys, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I'm gonna go to school where I could get something in life. I can't live here because my mom would not help me.
Since then, the two haven't spoken.
I haven't talked to my mom for almost 4 years, and I'm still trying to keep that streak to this day.
You don't want to have a relationship with her?
No, because it's like a toxic in my life. If I go back, she's going to try to get back into my life.
So here's the update. According to Julian, his mom still seems to be out to get him, even indirectly. He talked about recently needing to borrow money from his oldest brother, and when his mom caught wind of that request, intervened.
So my younger brother told me who was living with my mom. He's like, man, my oldest brother called my mom and said, man, he's asking for money to get back in school, and my mom told my oldest brother, don't help him. He moved out, let him do it all by himself. He doesn't need your help. And so when I found out about it, I was like, I didn't tell him about it. I was like, well, oldest brother, I asked for help. I see where you stand in life now. You are still my oldest brother. I'll take you anywhere in my life if you need it. But I see that if I need help from you, I can't get it.
Now, he still has a relationship with that youngest brother who still lives with their mom. Listen to how the brothers now have to communicate with one another.
Yeah, he has a phone, but I could never tell that it's either my mom or my youngest brother, so we made a code word.
Oh, good, good. So you have a code word to get through to your brother.
Yeah, it's like something from our childhood. It would be like, I'll say like 42, and then he'll say 1-2, because that's like our number right there.
And then you know that you have a private line of communication that your mom can't read.
Mm-hmm.
That's smart.
I'll say, like, right now, I feel a little bit better about life, but I could still have short memories of where I see myself. I was like, man, I actually was in that position, and I feel bad for my youngest brother for living with her right now. Even though he's 21, I could see, like, he's still under that control.
The day I picked him up, he had just finished up a job interview at the juice bar of a health club, which if he gets that job, would pay more than his current job at a drugstore.
From $11 to $13, it's like a little bit of a boost.
And that's not the only thing looking up for Julian.
Now I'm actually on the honor roll at Malcolm X with A's and B's, doing 18 credit hours, 5 classes.
Nice job.
But it was interesting. On one hand, when we were talking about his troubled relationship with his mom, Julian encouraged others who might be in a similar situation to rise up like he did.
I would say, like, for people that are under control over someone's, like, trying to kind of get rid of that controlling in your life and move out, as long as you have somewhere to go. Like, right now, I'm in school, I have my own insurance, I got a job, and now I'm getting a new job to pay more, you know, for more pay.
So you feel like you have freedom now.
Yeah.
And before that date in August of 2013, you felt like you didn't have any freedom.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I would say that for all my brothers. I'm trying to get my youngest brother out because he also applied for the police department as well as I did.
But on the other hand, there also seemed to be some lingering after effects of the mental abuse. And in my mind, those came through in this next answer.
What have you learned about your own resilience in being able to survive that and now be on the right track and thriving?
Well, I would say the only thing I learned from my mom is not to talk back to people. Because for my mom being abusive, I wouldn't talk back to her so I won't get into more trouble. So I learned how to keep my mouth closed.
Still, overall, it felt to me like Julian is on the up and up. He believes in himself.
That small tiger that grew up into the big one.
And is still confident in his decision to leave home.
Because I know right and wrong now, everything beforehand was that I was always wrong.
When did that click for you? When did the light bulb go off? Because it's, you know, hearing the story about the food, hearing the story about the ambulance and how she was pissed and not worried about your health and just worried about the bill. Those, for a lot of people, they would think right away, holy shit, that's wrong. that her mom, that his mom is treating him like that. But when did it click to you that her behavior was immoral?
Well, I was, it was probably when I went to therapy to talk about what happened, to release all the anger that I had, because it was I always bottled up my anger towards my mom. So I went to therapy, talked it out, found out. I realized, like, man, all this is wrong. I can never have this in my life or do this in my life to when I have kids.
And speaking of his own kids, he has made a promise to himself to be a good, loving parent, the opposite of what he experienced growing up.
Where my kids say, hey, you're actually a great dad. Thank you for being here for me.
Like I mentioned, the very next ride, I drove another man who is also estranged from his mom.
I guess my regret is not necessarily that we are where we are. I think there are just a lot of things between having a relationship and not having a relationship with her that I wish I'd handled better.
And we will hear his backstory in just a minute. But first, I want to say a quick thank you to WTTW Chicago and WTTW.com for their support of this podcast. And also, I want to tell you about one of the sponsors that is helping me to bring you this podcast for free each week, and that is TrueCar. 3 million cars have been sold using TrueCar, and for good reason here. Like I've been mentioning, I am not a negotiator, so buying a car, it's always been a really stressful experience for me at the dealership. But there's a service called TrueCar that is perfect for anyone else who might feel the same way. And that is because TrueCar lets you see exactly what other people paid for the same car that you want. It worked great for me. So here's how it works. You sign up at TrueCar.com. You enter in the exact vehicle that you're looking for, whatever bells and whistles you want. And then bam, you get to see what the car went for at several dealerships in your market. So this is probably the most valuable piece of information you can take with you into the dealership. So then from there, you get hooked up with a TrueCar certified dealer that has that exact vehicle. So again, when you get to that dealership, you are armed with the information you need to get that car for a fair price. Way less stressful. Plus, get this, TrueCar users save on average more than $3,000 off MSRP. So when you are ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features on TrueCar.com are not available in all states.
Sunday night, don't miss the new CNN original series, Believer, as best-selling author Reza Aslan goes on a spiritual curious journey into the worlds of Scientology, voodoo, and much more. On the premiere episode, travel to India and meet the Aghori Hindis that don't believe in spiritual purity or pollution. That means they aren't afraid to take care of outcasts like lepers. And some even practice cannibalism. Believer premieres Sunday night at 10 on CNN. So far in 2017, Forbes and Podcast One have already launched three highly acclaimed shows. The Interview with Steve Bertone features the business world's most interesting names, like Adam Carolla, Twitter founder Sean Rad, and Hollywood's own Jessica Alba.
So I spent a lot of my childhood in hospital and hospital beds.
Under 30 with Steve Goldblum talks to the movers and shakers, like Nation Builder CEO Jim Gilliam and NFL Big Game winner Martellus Bennett.
Guys are afraid to be themselves because of their marketing deal.
And The List with Art of Charms' Jordan Harbinger.
We'll get behind-the-scenes insight and information that doesn't make the print cut.
Next up, Sports Money with Mike Ozanian talking to team owners, athletes, and industry leaders about the enterprise and money behind supreme athletic competition. Forbes on Podcast One. Not just entertaining, informative. Subscribe now at iTunes and don't forget to rate, review, and share.
After I dropped Julian off at the place he's staying in Pilsen, I got a ride request from a man, I'm going to call him Nick. 39 years old, father of two, he runs the IT department for a foreign investment firm, and he's been doing that job for about the last 5 years. Now, in talking about regret, Nick said it's always been a turbulent relationship with his mom. No child abuse or anything like Julian, just kind of up and down. And for Nick, things didn't really start to fully go south until well into adulthood.
At what age?
So if I'm 40 now, things probably started going sideways probably when I was right about 30, 32, something like that. I'm almost 39. And some of it has to do, I mean, there was a certain point where I just made a decision. I mean, at about that age, I started to have my own family. I got, you know, married around then. And I mean, by the time I started having kids, it just, in my mind, like my mental, emotional energy, it was like, well, I can do one of these things or the other. I can either keep trying to figure these insane things out with my mom, or I can just kind of move on with, you know, my family and focus on that. And I decided to do that. And
at that point, in Nick's mind, it was bad enough with his mom that he couldn't manage his own family and his relationship with her at the same time. So he was left with a choice.
There were just episodes of kind of a lot of intensity where I, you know, to try to maintain or address or fix, you know, these issues in our relationship or just, you know, with my life or her life, it became all consuming. And I couldn't afford, I thought, to have that sort of thing happen when I was in the middle of trying to sustain my marriage or have
and
my kids.
Start your own.
Yeah.
Got it.
Just, I mean, when I was younger and single, it was just like, okay, this is, you know, even though it's disruptive to work and other things I'm trying to do, fine. But in some ways, I think I wish, and she probably wishes, that, you know, it had been important enough to me. And it's not that it wasn't, but to maybe fight that. But, I mean, that being said, there's not a one-sided thing. I mean, there's decisions I made and certainly decisions that she made that, you know, kind of got to this point, so.
I don't want to push too hard, but is there anything that you can share about the root of the problem, the nature of the rift?
Sure. I mean, it started out as a financial thing, and then really it's just kind of like its tentacles spread in terms of really the nature of my mom's relationship. And she's kind of a narcissist and I think has a hard time seeing the world beyond herself. And, you know, it's kind of like as this started to kind of blossom, I kind of explored the issue. It's just like, you've really always been this way and been this way to my siblings. And it's just, and it is very difficult to have that in life. So it started with, my stepfather had passed away and my mother was kind of in kind of a difficult financial situation. And I had a job, this would have been back in 2004, 2005. And so I couldn't buy her house outright, but I signed for her house and said, okay, the deal is this house is my name. You'll live here and you'll pay me rent and I'll pay the mortgage and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And she just kind of stopped paying the rent. And it was extremely damaging. I mean, it was just like, it's not because she couldn't. It's just at some point in her mind, she decided that it wasn't as important to take care of that obligation as, I don't know, to do other things. So,
yeah.
So that was very, very difficult. And we kind of tried to get through that. And that kind of culminated me having to evict my mom from a house that I owned. And things got really, really kind of unpleasant and sad. But even as we tried to move on from it, it was just, you know, one episode after another. Kind of just of that nature. Just okay. Kind of not, you know.
The follow through wasn't there.
No. And it just, I think it in somewhere in her mind, it was just, it's not like she didn't have to. And or there'd be a rationale that was. This is important. My mother's got legitimate, like, mental health issues.
Got it.
So there are these other things, episodes, issues with, like, hospitalization and, you know, being, you know, where it was just one crisis after another. And at a certain point, she was in Chicago, I was in Minnesota. And there's a certain point where I was like, this is too disruptive. I cannot drop everything and, you know, spend 4 days trying
That's so tough because then you have to manage the whole, okay, if there are mental health issues, that increases my empathy and my capacity for forgiveness, yep. But to a certain point.
Yeah, and that I think it was just finally hitting a wall with that, where I think for years and years and years, particularly after my stepdad had passed away, it was just trying to be, yeah, I felt like it was my responsibility to take care of her. But there's just a limit where it was, you know, this is too much.
So it's hard to process situations like this because you're only hearing one side of a certain story. The passenger side, and there's only so much information that you can glean within the span of a Lyft ride. But imagine having to evict your own mother. There's got to be a lot of complicated emotions that go along with a decision like that. And I couldn't help but wonder, even if he was technically or legally in the right, or perhaps financially speaking, that was his only option, what the guilt factor was.
The regret is, I think, just broadly the loss of the relationship. And it'd be hard for me to pin down, like, one action that could have changed or been corrected to. Because I don't think there was one, right? But I think in general, maybe having the disposition where, you know, I want both of these things to work. I can put the energy. I can, you know, maybe there were some conversations we had or some ground rules or an intervention. I don't know what. But I probably could have done more. But, you know, such is life.
Nick says that a month and a half ago, he and his mom had what he called a crazy interaction.
I got to know her about a month and a half ago. She just unloaded on me on a text message, just kind of let me know what a terrible person I was. And I was just like, I mean, and it's not, I think that what was strange, and this happens once a year or so, or mm-hmm. something, some strange guilt trip will come across. And so that, I mostly doesn't bother me. I mean, but this time it bothered me. And it was, and mostly because she bought other people in my life into the conversation. I was just like, you don't know these people. And so I was upset enough that I finally told my wife, I was
Were
like,
you engaged?
I did not directly, but I told my wife, I was just like, we're done. Like, we're not, I can't have this. It's just like, I'm blocking all of her phone numbers. I'm like, I can't do this over again.
Since then, over the last few weeks, Nick has been mulling over some complex feelings of regret, not just for himself.
And the regret for me, just as an adult, I think the big thing is, you know, my father passed away when I was very young, and my stepfather passed away. It's really just, some of it's just a desire to have, you know, to not want to be an orphan at, you know, 40. Mm-hmm. And it'd be nice to have those relationships and be able to kind of share those things and have that, you know, just a parent, you know, in my life. So it's in some ways, it's the loss of a concept as much as anything, right? I mean, I think, like I say, it doesn't feel like something that weighs on me. I don't wake up every morning, oh, geez, I really wish I could, you know, reconcile this relationship with my mom. It just has been long enough that this is the way it is.
Uh-huh. But also, regret on behalf of his kids.
It's not even as important to me as an adult to have that relationship, but I do regret that my children will not have a relationship with my mother in some ways. You know, kind of as flawed and difficult as that dynamic is, it will be strange as they get older. I mean, they're 6 and 4 now. It will be strange to explain, you know, I mean, they're aware that she's, you know, somewhere and that I've got a mom. And she's like, you know, why we won't see her and they won't know her and that type of thing. So I think that's, I think that's probably just, and this is probably the first time I realize this, that's where a lot of like the regret part comes from. It's just this.
And I was curious to know if Nick would rule out some sort of future reconciliation with his mom. And even though the wounds are clearly fresh from that crazy text message a month and a half ago, he still says he wouldn't rule it out.
So certainly not never. I mean, I think things could change. But I think what I would say is I'm not going to put a lot of work into making it happen, uh-huh. I don't think.
So going back to my original premise, as a new dad on his son's first birthday, seeking wisdom and perspective, I can't help but view these two passengers I drove that day as cautionary tales. And speaking of regret, one question I regret not asking either of them, and this always happens, there's always one burning question I don't get to. It was this: do you have any good memories of your mother? Because again, for me, being the lucky son of good parents, it's hard to imagine how these parent-child relationships can deteriorate to these levels. And that brings me back to the wise father who we heard from in the intro of this episode, who said this to me about parenthood.
You're right. You have to earn being a dad every day. It's not an entitlement. You have to earn it.
And now, before I sign off for the week, his full answer to how to earn such an important title.
You give your children, you know, love. You give them unconditional love. Yeah, I find a lot of times you'll see parents will give children conditional love. And that teaches them to adapt to those conditions in order to receive love. Because at an early age, that's what you want, right? But I think if you give your kids unconditional love and you prepare them to be adults and
to live their lives.
To live their lives, you know, as happy adults is very important. And I think parents, you know, oftentimes get caught up in trying to raise their children maybe as they were raised or something. And, you know, I think if you give them some kind of structure in life, that's important. But you don't have to fight every battle with them, right? You don't have to address every little transgression. You love them unconditionally, regardless. And I think they pass that on.
And I do promise to revisit more generally this topic of regret with my passengers, because I do think it's a very important one. But in the meantime, I would love to hear what you think of the stories and the advice that was shared in this episode. Again, it is Theo's birthday today, And now it's 19 minutes till his birthday party starts. So it's a selfish request on my part to want to hear from you. But you, based on all my feedback that I've gotten so far on the phone, you're a very intelligent and thoughtful group. So give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. Again, the number is 312-709-4667. And I've loved hearing from people who have called in with feedback. Quickly, I want to play a message that I got from another Lyft driver. This is responding to my recent episode on rideshare royalty 2 weeks ago, and she is sharing her craziest passenger story.
Hi, Anthony. My name is Kate. I live in Chicago. I was actually one of the first Lyft drivers in Chicago. I was in the first summer when Lyft came to Chicago. We had the giant pink mustaches that we put on the grill of our cars. That summer, nobody knew what they were. So people would like stop you to take pictures of themselves with your cars. It was really weird. But one of my first experiences was I picked up a guy who was in a rush. He was in Ravenswood, and he's like, "We need to go. We're going to O'Hare," and he had no luggage. I was like, "That's weird." And so I mentioned him, like, "You're going to O'Hare, but you don't have any luggage." He's like, "It's okay. It's like, I just need to go." And he's like, "Fly out now." I'm like, "Where are you flying?" He's like, "I'm not sure." And I'm like, "This is not good." And so I drove him to O'Hare, and I tried to keep things really chill and not escalate things. And I let him listen to whatever music he wanted. And so by the time we got there, he thought we were best friends or whatever, because we got there and he stopped and put his hand on my hand. And he's like, "I'm dead serious." He's like, "Let's go to Vegas together." It's like, No, thank you. And he, like, wouldn't get out of my car. I was at that departure lane where we could used to be able to drop people off. And he was, like, yelling at me by the end of it, being like, "Just come with me." He's like, "You have to be spontaneous. You have to live in the moment." I'm like, "No, and get out." So he finally ended up getting out of the car, and then he took my my rating down to 1 and gave me, like, no money, and then said that I was a violent driver. So that was crazy. So Lyft contacted me, and they were really understanding. I explained the whole thing and how uncomfortable I was, and they understood everything. But that was definitely the most scared I've been at that point. So,
Kate, I am glad you shared that. Sounds like you handled the situation very well at the airport, and also glad to hear your driver rating, which is all important. I know that from experience. I'm glad your driver rating wasn't affected there. Sounds like Lyft was pretty understanding about the situation. All right, so please call in with your anecdotes or just tell me what you think of the podcast, what you think I'm doing well, and also what you think I could be doing better. Again, the number is 312-709-4667. Also, only 9 days left until my big night competing at Dancing with Chicago Celebrities. I've been talking about this over the last couple of weeks. My partner and I have now learned all the choreography, and right now we are polishing our routine. It is all for charity. It's for the fight against breast cancer. And as of this recording, I still have to raise $3,800 to make it to my $5,000 goal. Again, it goes toward the fight against breast cancer. Really good cause. Thank you so much to everyone who has donated so far. No amount is too small. And you can find my donation page by going to Twitter. I pinned it. It's my top tweet on my Twitter, which is Anthony Ponce TV. Or you can just Google Dancing with Chicago Celebrities and find it there. So that's it for me for this week. Don't forget, while I do drive for Lyft for the podcast, Lyft is not a sponsor of the show, has nothing to do with the content of Backseat Rider, but like every other driver, I get a promo code, and my promo code is Backseat Rider, all one word. And if you sign up for Lyft or switch from Uber to Lyft, you just enter that into the payment tab when you sign up, and that will give you up to $50 in free ride credit and also help me out. So that's it for me. I'll see you guys next week. And as always, look for new episodes of Backseat Rider every Wednesday on podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, or subscribe on iTunes.